You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book, Who Owns the Future?, Jaron Lanier argues that digital networks like Facebook, Twitter, and Google have led our economy into recession and have hurt the middle class, and that the information economy we've built doesn't promote capitalism, but rather promotes a new kind of feudalism. Mr. Lanier, who currently works at Microsoft Research, is a computer scientist and musician. He's been credited with being the father of virtual reality and with coming up with that term, in fact. His new book is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased to welcome Jaron Lanier back to our show. Hello. It's good to see you again.
It's great to be here again.
When you say we aren't creating enough opportunities for enough people online, what kinds of opportunities are you talking about?
Well, when my colleagues and I worked so hard on networking technology in the past few decades, the idea was that this would be a new efficiency in society that would grow the economy and that it would create a wave of well-being.
It was also supposed to be the great equalizer, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And it has that potential. And on the surface, it seems to be doing it. I mean, that's what's always claimed. That's the cliche. But at the same time, since around the turn of the century, when it really saw widespread use, instead we've seen waves of recession and austerity and endless indebtedness and a loss of social mobility and an increase in income concentration. And if you look at the mechanisms that caused all those things, you saw a big computer at the center of every case. There was always somebody with a big computer who was using it to work out incredibly complex schemes to make sure that they collected all the benefits and everyone else got all the costs and all the risks and all the cleanup. And what I'm realizing is that unlike previous ways of technology, like, oh, I don't know, plumbing and the interstate highways clean water, like all of these things created widespread betterment, but our technology hasn't had the effect that it was supposed to yet in the developed world. I mean, we can talk about the developing world where maybe the story's different, but at least for us, it's had the reverse effect.
And you have compared the internet, which is called the information superhighway, with the building of the actual interstate highway system in this country. Now, that really transformed America, many would say, in a positive way. Of course, it also had some negative impact. Same
sure.
thing here?
Well, so the problem here is that when you build a technology that facilitates people doing things with each other, which could be roads, it could be digital networks, it benefits people to the degree that they are in line to be account. Their contributions have to be part of the accounting if you're going to live in a capitalist or market economy, or else they're left out. And so what's happened is we've allowed an economy to arise in the digital world where people can use gigantic computers to calculate their way to wealth, while the people who provide all the information to those computers do it for free. And the most egregious examples are in the financial sector so far, but I think we're heading down exactly the same path with all the other big computers, like the ones that run search and social networking and a bunch of other kinds.
Now, if we could back up, what would you have done differently? How should computer networks be able to create more wealth and security for the middle class?
Well, the great irony in this is that the origins of computer networking foresaw exactly this problem and how to solve it. So if we go back to 1960, we see the first proposals for setting up computer networks for communication between people. And the very, very first design was the hypertext from Ted Nelson, and that's the HT and HTML that we see all the time in web page addresses. And the idea was that everybody would get little tiny micropayments universally when information that they put up was used by somebody else. And then that would create a back and forth flow of wealth. And then that would create a growing market where most people would do better than if they were just sharing for free. That's the magic of the marketplace, is it actually makes most people do better than they otherwise would in a barter society. And he wanted to see that in the information economy. And he had a really good reason, because since the 19th century, people had been worried that better machines might start throwing people out of work, right? And in the 20th century, we found a solution to that problem, which is you still pay people for what they do, and the machines get better. You know, even if you don't have to deal with horses to move people around and you're driving this fun car, you still get paid if you're a cabbie or a teamster. And what he realized is we'd have to keep on doing that because the machines would get better and better. And
this is Ted Nelson?
Ted Nelson, yeah.
And why isn't he better known? Because he seems to have predicted so many things that have turned out to be true when everybody else had a very different vision of the future.
I think Ted might have a problem that is shared by – I'm told I have this problem too. I don't know. I think I might not have it as bad as him. But sometimes the people who are really at the core of new ideas are not necessarily the people who are the best public figures and not necessarily as good at playing the game. And so he kind of is – he should be much, much, much better known. There's no question of it. He's still with us. He's in his 70s now.
Now, are these big computers that you're referring to what you call the siren servers?
Yeah, in the book I call them siren servers.
How did you come up with that title?
Well, I was thinking, you know, in the book I talk about the ancient origins of the idea of information, and there are a couple of different fantastical creatures that show up in Homer, and he talks about the golden servile female robots of the god Hephaestus, who, you know, are sort of the prototypes for one idea about today's technology. But I thought the idea of the siren was an even better model of what we're doing, because we're building this thing that's seductive. I mean, the reason the sirens killed sailors is not by directly attacking them, but by seducing the sailors so that the sailors destroyed themselves. And I feel that we're kind of doing that with our computers. We're looking at very short-term benefits. An example is a really easy-to-get mortgage, but in fact you're buying into a system that's benefiting somebody else in the longer term. And I feel we've done something very similar with consumer internet services like search and social networking, where initially we're definitely getting some benefits and it's cool to get them for free. But in the longer term, we're undermining the kinds of jobs and ways of livelihood that could really exist when the machines get better and better as the century progresses. So the long-term price is just too high to pay. We have to start thinking of a different way to do things.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, whose latest book is follow-up to You Are Not a Gadget, is Who Owns the Future? Can you talk about the problems you see in the app economy?
Well, the app economy is a pleasant development in my point of view, because at least there are some people making some money from software instead of it all being free. The problem with the app economy is it's...
I only take free apps.
You only take free apps. Well... The problem with the app economy is that it's a winner-take-all economy. What happens when you try to use computers to calculate the perfect business, the perfect app store, the perfect insurance where you only insure people who won't get sick, or the perfect investment where you only make money and other people cover the risk? The problem with this quest is that it creates winner-take-all outcomes. So you have only a tiny number of token people. This is what we used to call the Horatio Alger story long ago. You have a tiny token number of people who benefit because they get the hit YouTube video or the successful app. And then you have very large numbers of people who live on hope, often in their parents' homes, it has to be pointed out. And the problem with that is in the end, it doesn't create a middle-class distribution. It creates this winner-take-all society with a tiny token of people who benefit and tons of people living on hope. And for now, we can afford it because most of the economy is still not about information. But gradually, we're going to see a world where robots are driving the cars and mining the minerals and many, many other things, I think much more than people foresee. And if we can't get the information economy to make a middle class by then, we'll have such a super elite that democracy will break.
And if we have cars that drive themselves and factories that work themselves, then we're going to have a lot of unemployed people, aren't we? I'm not sure that I can make the case against advanced technology because of that, because that has been an argument that's been going on since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly. It's a very old argument the anxieties about robots putting people out of work are directly responsible for Marxism and for science fiction and for many other huge waves of intellectual tendencies in the last two centuries. So it's a very old problem. And the solution has always been to keep paying people for the new roles they take on as technology gets better. But we've decided not to do that. We're saying we're going to build an information economy where information is free. So we've reneged on that contract.
And then when we try to put up a paywall, people resist because they've been getting it free.
Well, sure. It's a problem that has to be solved on a grand scale. You can't solve it in isolation. It's not something that can happen purely bottom up. That's the devilish thing about it.
You compare Instagram to Kodak to demonstrate a problem with the information economy that we have created. Can you explain?
Well, sure. Kodak was a company that employed hundreds of thousands of people with good middle-class jobs. So when you have a lot of middle-class jobs, you have a center of society that can outspend an elite tip, an aristocracy or a plutocracy, and that means that democracy can be stable. Instagram is not a direct replacement for Kodak, but it serves as a symbol. It's the brand of photography, probably the most prominent one. It sold for $1 billion to Facebook when it had only 13 employees. So this is another example of how there's a winner-take-all.
Was it worth that much? Because some of these things come along, they last for a few years, and then Instagram is replaced by some new app that somebody else has invented.
Well, the whole thing about markets is that things are worth what people are willing to pay for them. So we have to say it was worth $1 billion. The problem with it is not – I don't mind those people making the $1 billion. I'm kind of a Silicon Valley guy, and I love startups and whatnot. My problem is that in order to make that $1 billion, they have to shrink the overall economy by making the information that was going through their site free, meaning that they're erasing its value. And if you continue – that way of doing things, eventually, as more and more stuff gets automated, the overall economy will shrink in order to enrich the concentration of money and power for a tiny elite.
There's been a lot of talk about how the music industry has been affected by the internet, mm-hmm. And how record companies have been going out of business, how musicians can't really get paid for what they do. Now, it used to be that you toured to sell your records. Now you put out a record just so that you can tour.
Yeah, and to my mind, musicians are the test case for the rest of society. And if we were really confident that we're only screwing over the musicians, we could sustain that. The problem is that musicians are the canaries in the coal mine for every other kind of middle-class job. And you know what? I helped make up this argument. So right now, if you say this in hip circles, you'll get back this barrage of a response, which is, no. You make money from the live appearances and from ancillary things and reputation and barter, and it's actually great. They're freed from the labels. People can do fantastic, and all these, and they'll show you some examples of people who are doing well with it. And it's a very, very common argument, and it's wrong. It's phony, and I'll just tell you a couple of the ways it's wrong. One is that the number of people who can make their way this way is incredibly tiny. If you actually try to find these people who are surviving under the new system, especially well enough to become parents or plan for old age, it's a vanishingly small number. But the bigger problem is that the benefits they're talking about are informal benefits. They're the kinds of benefits you have in an undeveloped economy of reputation and barter. But it's not that we've created a socialist paradise where there are no formal benefits for anybody. Instead, they all concentrate around the giant computer.
And that's why we see fewer record stores, fewer video stores, because the computer has replaced them and the pay system is different.
Well, what you see is a generation of wannabes, of hopefuls. You see these – and, you know, if I was 20 right now, I'd definitely be running around in a van promoting shows online and crashing on people's couches that I found online. And it'd probably be a cool life, and I'd be filled with hope. But in the big picture, it's not leading to a sustainable society.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, computer scientist, musician, best known for his work in virtual reality research. In fact, he coined and popularized that term and received a Lifetime Career Award from the IEEE in 2009 for his contributions to the field. Time has named him as one of the Time 100. That was in 2010. You didn't make the list this year, but maybe this book will get you back on the list next year. And the book is Who Owns the Future? It is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll be back with more. We are back with Jaron Lanier, whose latest book is Who Owns the Future? It's published by Simon & Schuster. Searching with Google or using Facebook for social networking is free, but do they actually have a cost?
Yeah, in my opinion, we pay for them in the long term. And the analogy I draw is to the financial schemes that seem like great deals at first, where you get the incredibly cheap, easy to get into mortgage or the payday loan or something, but you're actually being drawn into something that in the long term reduces your future prospects. And in the case of Google and Facebook, the problem is that their business plan, the sort of only business plan left standing for a consumer-facing big computer, since we want information to be free, is what's called advertising. But what it really is micromanagement of the options in front of you for pay, you know. And so the real customer isn't you. You're the product, as is often pointed out. And somebody comes along and pays to use these deeply secret behavioral models of you to optimize what the options are in front of you for the benefit of some, you know, whoever is paying for it. And a lot of it's benign. A lot of it's just for coffee or whatever. But in the long term, in order to sustain that model, the jobs you might do to earn money have to be defunded. Otherwise, their model can't work. Here's an example. Right now, 3D printers are a huge rage, and I think they're delightful. I'm really into them. These are these devices that you can just program to spit out an object, and they'll print it out in three dimensions. You can get a working device out of them. So when those become better and more widespread, they'll start to replace factories as a way to get a lot of objects. And
we just read that a gun that fired
right.
was created by 3D printing. Later, we're going to be talking to somebody who is one of the creators of nanotechnology, and he predicts another kind of future where you use atoms to create things.
Yeah, Eric,
manufacturing in your home.
Eric Drexler.
The NRA must be thrilled.
Say hi to Eric. I'll be out of the studio by then, but we're old friends from way back. But the problem with this is that if the information to drive these machines that print out the objects is free for the benefit of Google, then the making of those objects won't be a job. Like the more advanced technology becomes, the fewer jobs there will be if information is always going to be free. And so gradually Google will have nobody left to even buy the advertisements. It's gradually destroying itself.
But is it free? Because they are all collecting information about us and selling that information as part of the big data aspect of the internet.
Google is free in exactly the same way that a mortgage during the 10 years ago was a great deal. It's free in the sense that somebody's enticing you into a bargain that's good for them immediately and really bad for everybody else in the long term.
Now, don't they even know the quality of your computer? For example, if I try to buy an airline ticket online, can't they tell whether I'm using a good computer or a cheap computer and price accordingly?
Well, yeah, there's a that's one example of how this new world works. One of the travel sites, in this case I believe it was Orbitz, was caught estimating how much people could afford to spend by looking at the kind of computer they used. But this is only one little tiny example.
It's called differential
pricing, right. In general, these giant computers are getting enough information about you to get some kind of advantage of you, and it'll vary from time to time as things go on. It'll have to do with influencing how you vote, influencing what you buy, influencing who you date. And like I say, a lot of the individual examples are perfectly benign, but the overall trend is towards a manipulated society that benefits whoever happens to own the biggest computers.
So can you explain what's happening when I'm on some website? Let's say the New York Times website. Mm-hmm. They're collecting information about me. Is it the articles that I look at?
Well, the New York Times is caught up in
this. I don't mean to pick on the New York
Times.
No,
they're fine. They just gave me a stellar review, so I have to like them. But but the thing about the Times is that, like all media businesses, they're trapped in this pattern right now. So in order for them to survive, they have to go through songs and dances to appeal to Google's servers and some others so that the big computers will like them and send them the crumbs that are needed to entice them into the game that benefits primarily the big computers and them only secondarily. And in order to do that, they allow all of these little spying programs to track which articles everybody's reading. And it's not as creepy on the Times as it is on some other sites where the reporters are told to use words that appeal to the big computers as opposed to people, or where the title is constantly being changed to optimize based on feedback. So it's designed to appeal to you based on a behavioral model of you individually. And as I say, in the immediate sense, you look at it, well, it might be silly, but it's survivable. But we have to look at the bigger picture. In a world where automation is getting better and better, it means that we'll have reduced prospects. We're being treated only as subjects of behavior mod instead of as productive citizens in an information economy.
There's an article in today's New York Times about Google's new high-tech glasses, Google Glass, and the privacy issues that it presents. It can take photographs or video just by winking and looking at something. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, first of all, this whole idea of wearing a little eyepiece so that you can see things is something I'm, of course, interested in. I made and sold I sold the first commercial things like that many years ago.
Virtual reality eyepieces.
Yeah, these sorts of goggles. Well, also the see-through ones, which we call mixed reality or augmented reality. So, of course, I love the technology. The problem isn't the technology. It's the business model. And I really am fond of people at Google. But nonetheless, I think despite themselves, the seductions of having such a big computer kind of corrupt all of us. And I think that the particular business model that they're using to bring this stuff out is just plain creepy. But it's not the device itself that's the creepy thing. It's the business model. It's the idea that what things that people see go into this giant computer where they're routed, and the people who are photographed have no rights.
Everybody becomes paparazzi.
Well, see, there's a way out of this. If we go back to Ted Nelson's original idea, if there are bits that exist because you exist and those bits turn out to be valuable, you should be compensated if we're going to have an information economy. And what that would mean is that a picture of you would create a debt to you, whether it's the government using street cams to track you or whether it's somebody wearing something on their head taking a picture of you. You could set a price which would determine how much privacy you want. And I know that sounds like a crazy, exotic, complex idea.
And who would pay? How would you be paid?
You'd be paid by the people who actually wanted to make use of that information because they'd enjoy looking at it or they wanted to use it as part of an analytic thing. And you'd be able to determine how accessible it was to them through that price. And I know when I just said that, there are a lot of listeners who are saying, oh my God, that sounds so crazy. It sounds so complex. It sounds so exotic. And all I'm doing is I'm recalling the ideas from the birth of the internet. It's from the birth of networking. We've become so used to a certain way of doing things that isn't sustainable that it seems like this inalterable, deterministic certainty. But there are other ways to do things that are actually better, even if they sound weird at first.
Well, when Eric Schmidt was Google's chief executive in 2009, he said, I'm quoting, if you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place, as a response to people who raise questions about technology that gathers data from users. Is that the prevailing attitude in Silicon Valley where you work?
I've known Eric a bit for a very long time, and I'm certain that he feels deep regret at having said that. I think that I'm sure in his mind he views that as a gaffe, as like one of those gotcha things, like, oh my God, I can't believe that came out of my mouth. I'm at least, if you ever interview him, you should ask him, because I suspect that's what you'll hear from him. I think it's a demonstration of how when you're enjoying the benefits of wealth and power that we enjoy, and believe me, I'm part of this world and I benefit from it. So I'm speaking not as a critic from a distance, but as a participant who just thinks we're building the wrong world. But you get so seduced by the incredible power and privilege that you can start to have thoughts like that are just unbelievably creepy. Just for a moment. I'm sure on consideration it's not something he'd ever want to repeat.
My guest is Jaron Lanier, whose latest book is Who Owns the Future? It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, many people have given social networks credit for fomenting political and social change. They can be used for fundraising, for organizing a movement, for spreading information, and they've been credited with playing a big role in the Arab Spring movement. Do you believe that this is a positive development?
I think there's an element of that story that's true that we hear all the time. I mean, I want to point out what I'm talking about is the future of employment and the distribution of power in a society and how it can't be too centralized if we want a democracy. In the meantime, on the way to that, there can be all kinds of little benefits to the way we're doing things. And I think some of what you're saying is so, or what you're describing that's said so often by others. But on the other hand, I do have to point out that during the same period that the Arab Spring was going on, the people of Burma achieved an opening without the use of digital technology, and many revolutions in the past had occurred without it. And
later I'll be talking about Bunker Hill, and that started the American Revolution.
And there was no internet. So, I just because these things can be helpful, we shouldn't sort of worship them. And I'm particularly annoyed at the Silicon Valley tendency to give ourselves credit all the time. Like, oh, we freed the world. Like as soon as you're praising yourself too much, you're probably kidding yourself. And I think we especially have to be cautious about to call somebody else's revolution, the Twitter revolution or the Facebook revolution, is profoundly disrespectful to them.
You mentioned the use of computers in finance. They enable high-frequency trading, which many people blame for all sorts of problems, including the erroneous tweet that the White House had been attacked, which led to a massive but temporary nosedive in the market. Mm-hmm. If humans had been dealing with the whole thing, they might have checked to see if that story was correct before they started selling off.
Well, since we're in New York City, I'm sure there's some of my old quant friends listening who are running these very schemes. And I know so well just the joy of working on these algorithms and on the big computers. And it's just fun to do this stuff. The problem with high-frequency trading, of course, is that, first of all, it's kind of unfair because these traders have access to the data totally before anybody else and at these incredible rapid rates. The rates are so rapid that information from the real world can't really penetrate. So they really just form a little world unto themselves. And the strange thing about it is that if there was only one high-frequency trading scheme at all, then there might be justification for it, because then it could say, oh, it's discovering little fluctuations that represent tiny inefficiencies, and it's canceling them out, so it's performing a service. But because there's more than one, they create these resonances with each other where they're just milking the rest of the market to absolutely no benefit at all. So strangely enough, that's the one place where a monopoly would actually make more sense.
The cost of college has been climbing. Is technology one of the reasons why?
I think it is.
Despite the fact that often teachers are being replaced by classes that you could take at home?
What you tend to have when big computers enter a situation is a gradual devaluing of everything that isn't immediately next to the biggest computer. So what you tend to have is sort of a hypervaluation of whatever finance scheme or information routing scheme is run by the biggest computer, and everybody else gradually sinks. And in education, what's happening is there's this wonderful drive, which I have tremendous sympathy for, of making online courses free and making college education free, that at the same time is tied to the system where if you're going to pay, it's becoming more and more expensive and more elite. And in particular, you have to take in more and more debt, and you have a student debt crisis of extraordinary proportions. And I view these things as being part of the same general trend, where when people are being organized and manipulated by giant remote computers without even realizing it directly, this is the result you get. You get this sort of spread of free stuff, but also loss of options and poverty that pays for it. So it's actually expensive in the long term.
There are a lot of questions about how humans changing technology and civilization fit together. What are a few of the ideas about this, that what you call technological humors?
Oh, yeah. Well, I noticed over decades of conversations about this in Silicon Valley that certain kind of cliches or tropes just kept on coming up and up over and over again in conversations. And so I tried to make a little system to describe them just for myself. And so, for instance, one of the things that happens quite frequently is you'll have somebody who's coming from this hyper libertarian Ayn Rand kind of a position, which is extremely common and popular in technical circles. But then when they get to the sort of end game, when the machines get really good sometime in the 21st century, all of a sudden they turn into a socialist. And then everything will be free and we'll all share. And I'm like, well, what's this switchback from Ayn Rand to socialism at the end game? Does that make sense? And I've tried to sort of chart these things out, and I call my system the technological humors of the different positions that people seem to ricochet between.
Is it possible to create technologies to improve the world without also creating technologies that cause harm?
No. I view the human condition as being a perpetual a perpetual race to undo the mistakes that we've just made that still somehow overall betters us. This has been true since Eve bit the apple. Every technology has side effects which have to be undone. Every act of goodwill has mistakes embedded in it. And yet we're compelled to move forward. We can't run reality backwards. We can't go back to an entirely natural and pure way of life. Life is better than it used to be. We forget how bad the past was routinely. It's an illusion. We're compelled to go forward and to deal with the challenges of undoing the mistakes of the last generation, and they will be responsible for undoing our mistakes. There's no other way.
We are talking about technology as a way, something that will lead us to immortality. And it's interesting that when you look at the concepts we had of the future 50 years ago or so, they were so different from what they are today. Space travel, colonizing the moon, flying cars. And now it seems to be all about technology and collecting big data.
Well, you know, having a big computer has turned out to be the fastest and biggest way to accumulate wealth and influence in history. It's better than having an oil well or a railroad. I mean, it's just wild. And that seduction has reduced our imagination. So now everybody is in this sort of tedious world of how can I milk the data? How can I build the bigger computer? And it's boring me out of my skull. And I think we should try to get back to a more heroic idea of what technology is for.
And that you advocate a humanistic approach to providing a solution to some of the problems we've been discussing. But do you think we'll ever be able to own our own online identities?
We have to, or we'll have to give up capitalism and markets and find something else. And for my socialist friends who cheer that, they should be warned that the alternative would probably not be pretty from their perspective. If you try to create a socialist paradise, it'll fail in a computer age because some people will have bigger computers. People might be created equal, but computers aren't, you know, and then you'll have incredible disparities of influence because the people with the bigger computers will have vastly, vastly more influence.
Jaron Lanier's latest book is Who Owns the Future? It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's such a delight to be here every single time.